Welcome to the show. We actually have a large introduction tonight, so I'm going to stop the music and I will continue the music until my host call in. This is Jane Hoffman broadcasting live to you from Duluth, Minnesota. Tonight we will discuss several topics. We're going to discuss the movie The Experimenter about a social psychologist named Stanley Milgram who designed a psychology experiment in which people think they're delivering electric shocks to an affable stranger, but what the real subject matter and experiment was about was conformity, consciousness, and free will. They were not required to deliver shocks, but they conformed out of obedience to the tester. We'll get into that in a few minutes. We're also going to discuss about how every 7 years all the cells change in our bodies, and does that change our personality? We have up to 50 to 200 million cells in our body. Some scientists argue that the core of our brain, those cells never change, so therefore our personality can't change. But I'm going to briefly read you this paragraph. Are you the same person now that you were 15 years ago? In fact, are you the same person you were just 7 years ago? Most of us heard the old saying that every cell in the body is changed over a period of 7 years. But recent investigations have uncovered facts of far more significance to us, human beings. Concerns the emotional, physical, and mental changes that seem to occur in approximately 7 year intervals. Of course, there are no fixed boundaries, and so one may achieve these levels of maturity at any period of our life. So what follows are simply general changes you may find. Rudolf Steiner, the great teacher of anthroposophy, not anthropology, but it's called anthroposophy, said that the seven-year cycles continue throughout life and are of the utmost importance to doctors, teachers, psychiatrists, and social scientists. Without some smattering of these changes, it is difficult for anyone to understand the relationship of any given individual with his or her environment. So I've tried to summarize what Steiner and others have said about the cycles. Before the definition is started, I feel it is important to say that as humans, in fact, any life form, we are creatures of great polarities. Of the philosopher Erwin Goodenough said, a book on love, loyalty, or justice would gain little but pedantry by starting out with a concise definition. Only as we describe the various conflicting elements associated with such words can we finally arrive at a meaning that includes complexities for important matters that we understand, not as we simplify, but as we tolerate the paradoxical. I'm almost done, John. One of the great paradoxes of our lives are that we are constantly going through such enormous mass changes every day. Daily we pass through an extraordinary change that we often take so much for granted. We miss the wonder of it. The change occurs between sleeping and waking. For most of us, being awake is when we most fully feel ourselves. Compared with the sleeping, is a period which we lose any focused awareness of being an individual, and we sink into what is generally called unconsciousness, the lack of personal awareness. I'm going to stop there for a minute because I want to make sure that my co-host can hear me. Good evening, John.
Hello, Janessa Hoffalophilus. How are you?
I'm charged up tonight. Part of the reason is I've seen two good movies back-to-back in the last 2 days.
Nice.
And the other reason is, were you able to hear my full description of the show?
Yeah, it was actually, it came through loud and clear.
Good. Well, I was watching Midsummer Murders a few nights ago, which is a series on Netflix. It used to be on the British BBC. Anyway, there was a character in the movie, John Nettles, the inspector, the chief inspector, goes around interviewing people about murder, and he interviewed this elderly gentleman, and the elderly gentleman answered him, "How do you expect me to answer a question that happened 30 years ago?" I was four different persons back then, because he brought up the concept of molecular energy, and our cells change every 7 years, which leads people to theorize, can our personalities change, and can we become totally different people every 7 years? So I thought it was an interesting concept, whether it's true or fiction. Nobody knows, but my little theory that's an offshoot on that is that, yes, we have molecular energy, and we also have kinetic energy. We're attracted to people with energy and substance and like and core identities who ignite us. And even on a show like this where there's divisive tension, it's still some kind of energetic molecular action. So
wow.
Based on people's history and their knowledge of the Bible and their life choices and their life events, like things they can control versus what they can control, like where they live, they can control that, but can they control maybe like if somebody in their life dies suddenly? Do you think people can go through a thorough personality change just based on our biological changes in our body?
I think you can. I've seen it happen with a lot of people. I work with music and entertainment, and I can tell you I've met friends that they were performers, and maybe they were shy, or their act was kind of mellow or boring. And I maybe disconnect from them and see them like 4 or 5 years later, and they're dynamic, they're exciting, or they've discovered this new thing. You know, an interesting thing, it may not relate to the common group, but there's a power rock singer, considered probably the greatest heavy metal singer, certainly by a lot of people. His name's Ronnie James Dio. He fronted Black Sabbath for a while, and he was also in a band called Rainbow, I believe. And then he finally had his own project called Dio. And there's diehard Dio fans. He's the subject of in the movie, I think it's Jack Black, The Pick of Destiny. And he makes a cameo appearance as he's kind of like this rock god and mentor.
Is the name of the movie Pick of Destiny?
Pick of Destiny. It's actually a very entertaining movie. In it, in regards to Dio, the point is that there are video clips of him when he was in high school, and he's like this romantic ballad crooner, you know, singing this kind of, you know, stuff that Frankie Valens would sing, or, you know, Sinatra, or any of these, you know, a very, very charismatic, very, you know, mellow voice. And you just wonder, how could you get this super powerful operatic monster voice out of this little guy? I mean, he's probably like 5'2 or something like that. But he tapped into whatever it was, and it's rare that you see someone that can sing very mellow and sweet also do this super powerful, you know, rock style. And I've seen this with a lot of performers, and some people can't make that transition. They want to be something else, and they just can't. You know, they have limitations.
Yeah, I think people go through progressive changes. There's only one part of this theory I fully disagree with, like, things that strongly mold you as a child, for example, the personality of your parents and their influence over you, maybe something like a tragic event in your life. I think those things you kind of carry with you from cradle to grave. But for example, I can think of one example that similar to that rock musician you mentioned. Like when I was in high school, I turned red in 10th grade speech class. Like, I could barely handle standing in front of people publicly speaking. Then I went through that stage of the athletics where I was a good runner. And then when I was 29, I wrote a one-act play for my church. And then I got into the entertainment industry kind of through the back door without really planning it. And then my play went on to cable TV, and then the theater experience pretty much changed my personality, where I was able to direct actors. My artistic director let me direct professional actors. And I went from, like, you know, Podunk, Minnesota to directing people who had been on television. And then basically only writing one play in my life. Like, it was just kind of like out of the blue. You know, I just decided to join this one-act play contest. So I went from a shy person to a confident person. But then when my daughter died, I probably retreated for a while. And I also noticed molecularly, like, when you live in a climate like you were talking about on several shows, like where it's below 30 degrees for maybe 4 months out of the year, like, I think in the environment has a strong impact on our personality. Like, it might even make people paranoid or withdrawn, or it might make them be angry and a bigger fighter because they're surviving bigger odds. There's all kinds of factors that could play into people's personality changes.
You see that a lot when high school, when you graduate, 20 years later, you may go to a reunion. And you'll see the most likely to succeed person, or the most, you know, talented, or the most beautiful, or whatever. And you'll see that person 20 years later. And, you know, like for the gals, the homecoming queen, sometimes they keep it together. But a lot of times you see them, it's like they gained 30 or 40 pounds. They look nothing like they used to. They just gave up on themselves. Maybe they went through a couple bad marriages. And then you look at the nerd person, you know, the person is a geek, or the gal that just didn't fit in. And they blossom, and, you know, they're beautiful, or they've had some cosmetic surgery, they've done their hair different, they wear stylish stuff, or they're super successful, they own their own company, you know, or they're a fitness trainer or whatever, you know, and just their whole persona is different. So a lot of that, it depends on those how they deal with adversity. Like, the person that's naturally talented a lot of times is cruising. They don't have to really try. They're not driven because they're beautiful and they're smarter than everyone else. And it's that person that's the underdog, that's at the bottom of the pile, that has to struggle. You know, for some people, it destroys them, but for others, if they have a strong will, their whole focus in life is to succeed, and they don't stop. And they just keep going and going, and it's amazing. You see this happen a lot in life.
Yeah, that brings up a good point, and I do see Don's on, been on hold 2 minutes. By the way, the topic tonight, Don, is psychology, and every 7 years our body fully changes, replaces their cells. And the question of the day is, do our personalities change every 7 years within the molecular structure? So before I bring Don in, I'm going to talk about two other points. So let's say there's someone who's kind of like a closet shy person, but they have good computer aptitude skills. So between 18 and 25, they go to school, they sharpen their skills, then they become like, you know, like a top computer programmer for a big company, or maybe even a little company. And then they grow with confidence and skill level. So then you have to combine that with chance and opportunity, because nobody really becomes successful without the possibility and opportunities that exist. Like, are the computer programming jobs available in your city, blah, blah, blah? Do you have to move somewhere else to become successful? So those are things that factor in. Now, I want to bring an interesting aspect into this personality perception. So I found a roommate. His name's Peter, and he moved in, actually he paid me on Monday, but he hasn't moved in yet. He's moving in tomorrow. So he's 28 years old. He's a computer music person, but he described himself as asexual, which by dictionary definition, it means someone who has no sexual feelings or acts upon sexual feelings. Now, you think about someone who is 28, does that mean he's thrown in the towel on romance? or that he just doesn't want to pursue that line in his life. And then you think about people like my friend Kathy, who she ran a newspaper for like 15 years. She got up to 270 pounds and now she's on disability. Like, what makes people throw in the towel and just stop becoming motivated? And I'll let you, I'm going to pull Don in, and then either one of you could comment on that. Good evening, Don.
Good evening, Dan. Good evening, John. Good evening, everybody.
Yay.
And by the way, John, Don's in the Uber mode, so he
nice.
Might dip in and out.
Yep.
So, Don, what do you think of our conversation so far?
Interesting. I like it. It's a change of normal politics and whatever. In terms of the fact that we're going to the root of all of the problems, where all of the problems come from, and I kind of agree with Jung and Freud and everyone that these are deep-rooted sexual problems. That basically a kid growing up is confused naturally, period. And when they reach that age where they actually think about sex, which is about 7, 8 years old, then their environment determines quite a bit on what they will think, who they will be, and how they will perceive being in adulthood, at least adolescence, because in adolescence everything happens. You've got unsolicited sex, you've got rape, you've got other kinds of.
But a lot of people don't act on that sexuality till they get older. For example, I didn't lose my virginity till I got to college. I know my
right.
twin sister waited till she was 21. So not everybody has a row in the backseat of a car at 16.
No, that's not my point. My point is that we are all sentient beings. I already know that nature is nature. And I've mentioned this a couple times, that procreation is the only way that we work. So psychologically, people have to adapt to whatever situations they're going to be in, because they will be in situations where, who knows, group sex, things like that. You know, and then the ages vary. People who have sex earlier have sex more often. People who wait, they may have it more often after they've had it.
But even if they
don't
have sex, if they don't have sex or not, do you think a person can go through a full personality change every 7 years when their cells get replaced?
No, they're separate and distinct. Your cells in your body are the cells in your body. They simply are there to make you move and be able to function. But the cells in your mind, even though they do change, they don't change the perceptions that you attain or you have. What does change is time, wisdom, those other esoteric mental situations that a person is in. The older you get, and this is pretty much been scientifically talked about, postulated, is that you get more conservative. You do get more conservative. The reason that I think that psychologically that happens is that people finally come to a realization that if they continue doing stupid stuff, they can't recover as quickly as they used to. Going out, staying out all night. Or arm or leg, and you know, some kind of broken bone or injury. The capability of listening to children. You know, that sometimes when you're younger you can hang with them, but when you're older it just frazzles your nerves. So those are all psychological traits.
reminds, I'm going to let John talk quick, too, but it reminds me, like, with my schoolyard job, you know, like, the weeks that I work graveyard, I work 9 p.m. to 9 a.m., and I get 2 hours off, and then I have to go straight into kindergarten lunch for a half hour, and then I have to go into kindergarten recess, where you stand outside for 30 minutes with 60 kids running around, and it can be anywhere from 10 to 35 degrees, because we've had a pretty good winter. Technically, it could be 10 below, but they don't cancel school unless it's 45 below zero up here. But, I mean, there's days where by 3 o'clock, I don't want to – I like the kids a lot, but by 3 o'clock, when five little boys have been misbehaving all day, it gets to be a bit much, you know? And I can even see the kindergarten teacher in her early 40s losing her cool. So, John, why don't you comment on what Don said?
Well, you know, he's right as far as with time and experiences changes who you are. You start to find out some things that just don't work, or you see repetitive cycles, like you stop believing just whatever people are preaching if it's not consistent with what reality is. Take a simple thing as exercise. They'll say, well, when you exercise, you tear down muscle. Your body rebuilds and actually adds some more, and your muscles grow. So based on that theory, if you keep working out, you should keep growing until you're like your arms are like 50 feet big. And you go, well, what stops that? Well, there's genetic predisposition. You're wired to a certain capacity you can't exceed. And a lot of these programs, and people start getting to mind over matter and to change your thinking, and, you know, power of attraction, you can attract wealth, you can make yourself successful. And you start getting these tangents, well, if I just keep thinking this way, I'll run faster, I'll jump taller, I'll do this, I'll do that. Well, actually, you're genetically programmed to start dying, you know, once you stop growing. So, you know, when you're 40 or 50, you're not going to be faster, stronger, or better. And that also influences the being conservative part that Don talked about. You just don't have the energy, the drive. You know, there's something inside when you wake up that says, let's go get them, that makes you take on the world. And when you wake up in the morning and you have half a tank of energy, you go, you know what? I think I'd rather stay in bed. So I think the
That's
point
funny
that you
mentioned that, because I think people at our age, like you and me, and maybe even Don, I think we kind of enjoy a little bit of a routine, like predictability. Like, we're not going to take on the whole world.
That comes with age. That comes when your personality says, okay, I can't do what I used to do. But the body, though, the rejuvenation, John is right in terms of the fact that once we reach a certain point, then our bodies automatically begin to die out, if you will, slow down. But the rejuvenation process, that comes over time, too. So it's not like we rejuvenate those cells every 7 years. You rejuvenate some every 5 years, some every 8 years. So generally you...
Well, I think some people do try to defy the odds. Like, I do know a few people in their 60s who are still marathoners and ultra marathoners. So, I mean,
no,
people don't just give up.
That's what I was going to say is that with exercise, you can prolong all of that. And that's what exercise is all about. No, you don't want to exercise until your arms are 50 feet long or wide or whatever John said. But you do want to maintain a cardiovascular regimen that will keep your heart, ergo your blood, your oxygen level, the transportation of your waste, the distribution of your hormones at a relatively constant level. That way you don't need to take supplements as much, you know, the vitamins and the pills and the pain, feeling the pain and everything like that from arthritis. From inflammation, arthritis is from inflammation of basically eating too much sugar and carbohydrates. And so that's where you have a lot of problems and sugary drinks. So you have to kind of stay away.
Well, when I see people in the gym, when I see people in the pool, like they range anywhere from people who have lost practically all their mobility to people who are still go-getters at certain, later stage ages. So
right.
I think some people, they don't start conforming till it's too late, like till they almost lose a leg or they almost go blind. Then they all of a sudden, boom, they wake up. And then I overheard this blind guy say he's on a two-year waiting list for a seeing eye dog, and he had these thick black glasses on at the eye doctor.
Okay,
so,
I do want
you and John to talk more because I know at some point either one of you has to hang up, so I'm kind of going to take a back seat.
Wow. Well, kind of touching on that 7-year regeneration thing too, that's another issue is your body is making copies of itself. So you may be getting a whole new cell or it may be totally regenerated, but it's a copy of the same thing. So in a way, you're not really changing. You're just, you're replacing the blue t-shirt with another blue t-shirt. You're not getting a red one or a black one. So I'm not going to be an African male in 7 years or an Asian male. And again, you go, how come? Well, your DNA, your body has certain codes that are locked in there to protect you. That's come out. I can wake up tomorrow and go, I'm still John Yoder. I'm not going to be Jane Hoffman. And conversely with that, unless I have an epiphany or some life-changing situation that forces me to have to be different or to think differently, I'm going to stay the same way. I'm still going to speak English. I'm still good. I know a little bit of Spanish. I know some music. I used to be able to read music somewhat, but not that bad, not that well. And unless I alter that, unless I say, I need to change. I need to learn Japanese so I can go to Asia and do music over there. I need to learn how to read music better so I can communicate it to other musicians so I can get paid performing. Those kind of things factor into the person you are, but a lot of it is you are who you are just by how you were raised or how you were wired. Like we speak English because our parents taught us that. And it's not going to change unless we veer from that course that was set for us. So it's very interesting, the psychology of people and what changes them, what alters them. You go through a really bad divorce, you lose a parent, and suddenly, or you have a child, and suddenly it changes who you are, the way you think. And that's very powerful. Some people, it's a very positive experience. But it could also be a very negative experience. And I think we've seen a share of that, in the headlines every day. We see people altered permanently for better or for worse. And, hopefully we'll all learn to be better. But I think it's a little bit like...
Based on what you said, John, I'm going to segue into the second topic. It's a movie about the experimenter. It's about Stanley Milgram, who developed this obedience theory based on a psychology experience where students come into a lab at Yale and they're told to ask a patient in another room questions, and if the person answers wrong, they deliver electric shock. And the point of the experiments is not to harm the person answering the questions. It's to see if the students will obey the lab authority by testing people's consciousness and by delivering the shocks when told to do so. In other words, are they conforming to obedience because they're told to by the person in the lab coat and they respect that authority, or are they doing it even though they're not supposed to because the person in the room starts screaming And then you find out later in the movie that the person who's screaming is faking it. And the whole reason for the experiments is to see that if people will still deliver electric shocks, even though they think the subject is being harmed. And he parallels that to Nazi Germany, where the German commandos followed orders just because they respected the authority of Hitler. And by the way, Stanley Milgram died of a heart attack at age 51. He was a social psychology experimenter. But he also developed a couple other experiments, including, I'll get to that in a minute, about a lost letter exchange and a social networking experience that became the basis for 6 degrees of separation. So first, tonight we're talking about our biological molecular structure, and now we're going into social conformity. So do you guys see the link that I'm trying to make?
No, but good try anyway. For the most part, Stanley Milgram, he had, it was a movie. I put it like that because anyone.
It's his real life. He was a real person, though.
Who? The professor who brought these Yale students together and.
Yeah, he was a real person. Yes.
Okay, well, the bottom line is that that should have been against all regulations and any kind of morals. Because you're not going to try to have a student, an impressionable 19-year-old or whatever, having to go through the stress of doing that when the student doesn't know that that person is even actually being harmed. So
it's funny you mentioned that. You want to know why? He got in trouble with the ethics board because he had a job at Yale. Then he moved to a city college. Then he got promoted to Harvard. But they would not give him tenure because they feel like he had manipulated the students into believing something, and that
right.
He might have psychologically traumatized them into giving shock when they were scared not to do so.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And, so it was an unethical study for him. It sounds like he just wanted to get notoriety instead of...
Basically, he was Jewish, and it bothered him that the German soldiers would follow and carry out commands. And what he did is he used white and black students and other people of color to see... if the level of obedience to authority differed between cultures. And in 55% of the cases, people carried out the orders, even though it was morally wrong to do so.
Right. Now, what was that second point that you made? Maybe John can start elaborating on it.
The second point was, it also showed in the movie, by the way, the name of the movie is called The Experimenter, and Winona Ryder plays his wife. He also did a lot of things like leaving lost letters all over the city. And then there was like an address inside to mail it back. And like he tested how many people would actually send the letter back. And then there were different places they could send it, like to the U.S. Post Office or the Film Society or I don't know, like there was some criteria where he had to measure that. And then one time he dropped all these letters over a city like with like a helicopter. And he followed the statistical percentage of how many people actually returned the lost letters or attempted to return the lost letters. And then he did one more study on a bus where he took the train to New York every day. And he developed an experiment where they would interview people on the same train going in every day And some people were on the same train with the same people for 20 years. But this one person on the average only remembered four people at the train stop every day out of maybe like 50 to 100. And then they would have, in their imagination, they would think of what that person's life was like outside of the train, maybe the possibility of marriage, if that person was in a distressful situation. Like, for every person riding the train, they connected with an average of four people, and then it was like that 6 degrees of separation. Like, even though they were a virtual stranger, they wondered about their lives and kind of fantasized about it. So he did a lot of experiments, not just one or two. But he became notorious for it.
Well, I could see where, to a certain degree, I don't know if I would use the same methods, but I don't know how else you could test certain theories and without using innocent minds of young people. I think in a way he was kind of preparing them for life. Certainly, you see this all the time on YouTube and other media where people are scaring someone, you know, like pretending. There's this one, I know it's probably sick, but it's downright hilarious to me. I mean, this one where this guy pretends he's dressed up all in Muslim garb, and he has like a bag or a box. It looks like a bomb or something, and he'll run up to a group of people and like, he'll say something, you know, like Allah Akbar or whatever, and he'll throw the thing on the table or in the house or the building, and people run like crazy. The funny thing is the first time I saw it, I mean, because you see people running for their life and they're falling over and this and that, but after seeing a couple of these, it seems like it's staged, because sometimes it's like the guy's already left. People are running, and they always have the same reaction. And some of their reactions are almost like choreographed. Like they have to fall over, or they have to try to slam the door open and like jump out the window kind of stuff. But the point is, there's a lot of pranks like this that you see, and some of them even go wrong. It's like, you know, if you surprise someone, think you're going to have a knife in your hand or you're going to beat them up with a stick, someone's going to pull out a gun on you, or, you know, someone out there is going to beat the crap out of you. And you see that occasionally on some of these videos, that, you know, the prank goes wrong. But I think it's
like,
a great
purpose. Like people misinterpret it? They misinterpret it, you mean?
Trying to do, you know, and the guy's saying, oh, it's just a joke. It's like, it's just a joke. You know, you're scared, you know, I thought you were trying to really attack me. And, you know, I can understand the situation. You could give him a heart attack. You know, someone could pull out a gun and fire back, and before you can tell them it's a prank. But the point is, people conform all the time to situations that are unethical or that are crazy. And they do a lot of experiments where, you know, people are in a room and someone will do something stupid, like they'll stand up and look at the wall and sit down in a timed interval, and people waiting around will start to do the same thing. And they won't even question it. And they add person by person to the room, and the last person's like, you know, they'll ask them, why are you doing this? It's like, well, this is what everyone else is doing. You know, high school girls, their whole life is that thing, you know, wearing the cool thing. When guys do it too, but, you know, you gotta wear the cool thing, wear the cool makeup, hang up with the cool crowd. It's conformity, and there's safety in it. As long as I conform, I'm okay. It's very hard to be independent and strong and believe in yourself.
Yeah, I think this generation coming up behind us, they might be kind of antithetical, because, you know, like a lot of them come to school, even fifth graders, like with blue hair, green hair, purple hair. I mean, there's really no conformity in dress, makeup, or structure. I'm sure there's still a pecking order of popularity, but I think people, certain generations are bigger risk takers. And plus, like as John's discussed a lot in the past, that the moral fiber of our society has changed quite a bit. So that might cause institutional breakdown. But I do think basically what you said, conformity in a lot of social situations and obedience is pretty much the norm. Go ahead, Don.
Right. Yeah, no. So I had to leave for a couple seconds. But social obedience is the mainstay of our societies. And that's what the despots, our leadership relies on to keep the cloak of what they're doing over us, pretty much, those who are being oppressed or overlooked. But social conformity is such a non-democratic idea that has become, like you just said, Jane, a norm.
Yeah, it's funny that I don't want to get into the Michael Moore movie until Sunday night, but if you guys get a chance, watch Michael Moore in Trumpland. It's basically one night of stand-up in Ohio that he does, but it's very well done. But one thing that he mentioned in the movie is that, you know, the Pope came out and said a lot of things, the new Pope, and one thing that the Pope said is that capitalism is a sin. And he thought that Michael Moore thought that the Pope could actually be killed for saying something like that. Like, to say that a whole economic system is a sin, which means, you know, he's attacking the value system of people who are pretty much, you know, middle suburban conformists, or who knows, whoever the vast majority of the Catholics are. I'm just pigeonholing right now, but just try to radically turn core ideas upside down on their head is a pretty radical thing to do.
Well, you know,
he's been supporting the whole, you know, same-sex marriage. That's unheard of.
Yeah, he said that he would apologize to every gay and lesbian person for some, like, the biased treatment that they've been given.
He's only protecting his fellow clergy who are homosexual.
True.
I did kind of think of that. Yeah.
It's also a maneuver to avoid legal repercussions in the future, to not be deemed as a racially biased or prejudiced against minorities. That being the gay lesbian community. I think half of what he's saying is pretty right to a degree. Capitalism at its core raw values is, I wouldn't call it a sin, but it's definitely counter to a safe environment, because basically you're trying to mass produce products regardless of consequence to make the most financial gain, economic payback to yourself.
Right.
So the thing is, at its core, when you go to the nth degree with it, you basically rape and pillage the land. And if you try, and everyone kind of conforms to this in America, we just kind of go with it. It's like, hey, you know, it's a number one hit. Oh, here's the latest car. You need this car. You need this watch. You need these clothes. You need, really? I mean, what's wrong with just being a Native American or Aborigine, just, you know, walking around with just your simple clothes and your simple tribe with your simple foods? That's all you need to live. You'd be doing this for thousands of years, but we want more, and it's very hard to get people to turn it around. I think Michael Moore is a very interesting guy. He's very funny. He does have a sharp wit. I love his stuff, even though I totally disagree with him. He's very entertaining, only in the sense that he criticizes things, which is easy to do. But he doesn't really offer a better solution. Or in other words, like, he'll rip on our capitalistic society, the conservatives, and anything. But
actually, John, in this new movie,
yeah,
he gives kudos for Trump for
Why it said what?
Facing the auto industry who's exported jobs. Don, can you put... I got to mute Don a minute, okay? Just a second.
Oh, yeah, he's working.
Lord.
It's capitalism.
Hold on,
man.
I'm in a mood.
I'm going to the Sterling Summit apartment.
John, sorry about that. I muted Don.
There was capitalism.
Okay, this is a strange thing because he did this movie in Ohio, in central Ohio, in the middle of Trump country. That's why it's called Michael Moore in Trump Land, where they hardly could find any Hillary supporters anywhere. But another reason he did it in this particular town is because the name of the county was Clinton County. So it's kind of like a paradox. But in one portion of the movie, he says that, why do you care more about upcoming terrorist attacks, but you don't care about the 1 million people who died of health care issues because they had inadequate health care before Obamacare went through? 1 million people died, whereas if they had crossed the border from Detroit to Windsor, Ontario, they would have had automatic health care no matter what their financial situation was. So he tries to compare, like, people's sense of empathy, like, for things that the news keeps projecting, like the fear of Muslim terrorists versus people who can die in their own country because they don't have the right kind of health care. Now, he's talking about the pre-Obama years, you know, when he made that movie Sicko. But then, on the other hand, he spends a portion of the movie talking about how Trump was the ultimate FU candidate because he took on all the political and media establishment and pretty much, you know, like when he said he had that moment of truth in Detroit and that he told the Ford executives that he'll put a 35% tariff on any Ford car that's made in a foreign country like Mexico, and that he'll make damn sure that they don't get sold in this country because the cost will be too high. Like, he was praising Trump in that aspect, but then he spent 20 minutes of the stand-up in the movie talking about asking the audience straightforward, why do you hate Hillary Clinton? And then he gave examples of all the good things that she's done throughout the years. And then at one point he showed a clip of Donald Trump, who was interviewed right after Bill Clinton got impeached. And Michael Moore was doing a show on Bravo. And he basically was going around trying to find Hillary Clinton a new date, like a new man, because they thought the Clinton marriage would implode. And Donald Trump stood up there during the interview and said that there's no way Hillary's going to leave Bill. She knows him best out of everybody. I know their marriage will last and they'll have a successful marriage and that, you know, pretty much that they'll stand by each other. So, like, Donald Trump was really cute back then and he was very attractive. And just to kind of watch him say and talk like that about Hillary Clinton was kind of like amazing to me.
Well, it is interesting because Michael Moore, you know, one moment you think he's like, he's praising Donald Trump, and then the next moment he's on ranting on how he needs to be impeached and how he's the, you know, the worst thing in the planet. So it's kind of interesting. I think a lot of it was to hype his movie. You know, he basically kind of goes counter to the grain.
Well, I think what I was trying to say is that Moore was, okay, the audience was probably 80% Trump supporters, 10% independents, and 10% Hillary voters. But what he was trying to do is he was trying to force the audience to look at both sides of the fence. And then he at one point he said, name three good things you'd say about your worst political enemy. And then he stood up and talked about three good things that George W. Bush did, including giving a lot of money for AIDS research in Africa. So he was trying to get the whole object of this whole movie called Michael Moore and Trumpland was to get people to look at the other side and try to make them understand within themselves on why they always want to vilify the other candidate or the other party. So that's what he was really trying to do.
I think, too, though, what he does is he criticizes things that he likes to exploit. Like, in other words, kind of the things that he would promote would be a socialist kind of government where, you know, the government takes care of everything for you. But yet he's in an industry that promotes individuality and in capitalism. Go out and see my movie. If you had a totally socialist government, they would be like, you can't say this or that. It's not government approved. You just here's the money you need. You should be spending charging so much money at the movie theater. We're just going to have government regulated prices. The government recommends these shows that you can talk about these ideas because the government thinks this is best for you. So that's where, you know, he kind of like he's trying to have his cake and eat it. You know, he's trying to be free thinking, capitalistic, you know, make as much money as possible, but then criticize everything about that so that it's so much better.
Well, this is one thing that, okay, I've seen him through many stages of his life. Like, one of his best movies was called The Big One, about how all these manufacturing jobs left the Midwest and he went around to these factories and he interviewed people who were about to lose their job. So I've seen him do things on a low-key, less politically explosive level. But I think what really struck me on this movie was, like, it was pretty mundane the first 30 minutes. But then when he got to talking more about people's empathy and looking at things from both sides, like, he brought up Mexican and people of color, you know, and blah, blah, blah. But the thing is that when you get to a certain point in the movie, it's about 70% into the movie, you get to this point where he's just kind of really trying to identify with what do people perceive a good America to be. Like, everybody wants their children to have a good education, like that kind of philosophy. So, you know, was going to mention one. The main reason that he even started out in this whole movie business, like, sometimes you kind of wonder how someone that heavy set and not attractive could get that much attention, because there's a lot of people on the corner trying to say things that never get that attention. But it started out with that movie Roger and Me about the Rust Belt in Detroit, where all those jobs went out the window and the Ford plants closed. And that's kind of how he caught the national attention. So I think where he comes from is he doesn't come from a point of non-capitalism. He comes from a point of where things stopped working. Like, you know, the golden years of America went on a downslide and people got screwed over. And I think that whether you're on the left or the right side of the fence, people can identify with that aspect of him. But he's the kind of person that you have to really listen to before you can make an opinion. Like, it's better to watch two or three of his movies before you really get a strong opinion on what he's trying to say.
Yeah, that would be, you know, that would be something to do. I've seen a couple of his movies through, and he does tend to do things in a sensational way that's funny, but also kind of impractical. Like, he'll do something like he'll go to a building, you know, of a corporation. He'll stand outside across the street with a megaphone saying, hey, here's an example of blah, blah, blah. You know, well, send someone out here to talk to me. Or he'll be on a boat going in front of, like, some military installation, challenging something that they're doing inappropriately and saying, you know, if you really need to come out here and address this. It's, you know, kind of like if I showed up at his house across the street and started yelling at him to come outside, you'd be like, are you kidding me? Or, like, I'm supposed to go out and conform to what you want.
Yeah, I have seen some of those movies. I think in Fahrenheit 9/11, like, some of his more subtle aspects of filmmaking, like when he filmed George Bush reading that story in a room, like, sometimes he's more effective when he's not being so direct. You know, like when he's just interviewing an unknown Joe Blow on the street. So
he tries too hard to get
his point across.
I mean, I was laughing when he did, I think, something about George and his merry men, you know, walking across the land, you know, and it kind of had this minstrel music going, and it was hilarious. I mean, he's got a very keen sense of humor, no doubt about it. Just sometimes,
like he kind of, you know, he does a lot of sarcasm, which I like, but, you know, I'm more from a conservative view, so he's doing it from a more liberal view, and it's funny, but sometimes he's like over the top, which is why, and it works. That's why people go see his movies.
Well, I think Michael Moore is opposed to Bill Maher, you know? Like, Bill Maher has more of a cutting tongue. You know, like, his wit is more acidic. Like, he'll always go for the conservative target. But Michael Moore does try to parlay in the conservative side and try to see their angle on things. And in the beginning of the movie, what I mentioned about mundaneness is, like, he was trying to make jokes about conservatives, like how they're orderly and they always have their keys on a key rack, right, you know, like right next to the door. And the liberals will be wishy-washy and say, like, where are we going to go for dinner? Whereas the conservative will say, we're just going to go to Outback Steakhouse and that's where we're going tonight. You know, so like he was trying to make jokes like that. But because he was appealing to a conservative audience in Ohio, I think he kind of had a tiptoe, you know, he didn't try to alienate anybody. He tried to make everybody feel inclusive.
Well, he's, you know, in that way, I would rather see Michael Moore stuff than Bill Maher. Bill Maher is really, it's kind of an angry guy, you know, and I get it. If you're a counter conservative, you know, you're going to rip on it. And so he has an audience that believes in it. And, you know, if I was more, freestyle hippie counter, you know, the establishment. There's a place for that. You know, there's a place for the rebel counterculture thing. I could see that, but just to me, he's just not uplifting. You know, he's not funny where you kind of chuckle. It's more kind of this angry, bitter guy.
Right.
Michael,
and plus, he's an atheist.
Yes,
like
Michael
it doesn't help. Bill Maher's an atheist, so he kind of like slams anybody who has any. You know, he doesn't always slam people with religious values, but he kind of always. I don't know, just some of his words and the way he frames things. Like,
well, you know,
I remember him describing the Republican Party as like aliens from another galaxy or something like that. You know,
that's always the problem when you deal with atheists is. It's usually a hopeless situation. Life has no hope. You know, they're going to die. There's no afterlife. There's no God. And so life is just this bitter pill of death and ugliness, and they're just going to find every hypocritical situation, every contradiction, anything that supports their view. But, you know, it's interesting because I was thinking about this earlier, and that is with atheism, the problem you have is that most of it's based on science. Like, okay, I have disproved that there's God. So therefore, you know, based on my research, God doesn't exist. And there's several problems with that premise. But one of them is basically to have science, you have to believe in laws of nature. Because they'll go, well, you can't prove God. So
oh,
can't put him in a
can I just cut in a second? Don, you're back on the air. I muted you while you were with the customer. So, Don, you're back on the air. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, so the point of what I'm making is that you can't do science without laws. So the issue is you're talking about the law but not believing in the lawgiver. You're talking about the design, but you're not going to acknowledge that there's a designer. And that's always going to be the shortcoming with an atheist is, you know, basically – I believe in the 55 mile an hour limit. I just don't believe in the cop that enforces it, the judge that upholds the law, you know, the system, the lawmakers that approve the law. Just because I don't see them, like I don't believe that someone made the 405 freeway because I didn't see them make it. It was already here. That's kind of the premise they deal with God. It's like, oh, I don't see God, but you see the work he did, and you enjoy it. But you don't want to acknowledge someone made it or conform to their rules or standards. So it's an interesting contradiction because they never really walk through that. If you believe that there are laws, you got to believe there's a lawgiver, a lawmaker. If you believe in a creation, then you got to believe there's a creator somewhere. And if you go with the thought,
well, you know, I kind of take that's very high level of cerebral thinking, and I agree with you. But when I look with at people like Michael Moore, who kind of has to homogenize his message so he can, you know, get a full audience without trying to fully alienate people. And then I look at Michael, that Bill Maher character, who is really just kind of a jerk a lot of times. But the only reason I watch him occasionally on YouTube, because I don't have HBO, is because some of his points are pretty prolific, but only in the context where he's not alienating people.
Oh, yeah. You know, he's a smart guy. And, you know, there are contradictions in the world. There are things that you can go arguments on both sides. So he's not without merit. It's just that if you buy into his program, if you're Bill Maher, you just end up being this angry guy. This is really bitter. You don't walk away going, "Huh, I feel really good about the world and life. I just feel like the Republican Party screwed me, and all these Christians have totally messed up my life, and we'd be so much better if we just annihilated them off of the face of the earth." I mean, that's really what it comes down to. He just hates God, hates anything to do with a standard of right and wrong, unless it's your own imagination.
I don't think hate's the right word, because a lot of times he expresses himself tongue-in-cheek. I think it's more of a lack of tolerance for anyone who thinks differently than he does.
True, but he gets into, I've seen him talk where he'll just say, you know, like Christianity or the belief in God was like, it's like a lead filling. And he said, "I had all these lead fillings. I didn't know they was bad for me. And then when I found out how toxic it was, it was poisoning me, that I had the dentist just drill it out, you know, just totally get it out of my life. You know, just it had to be taken out." And, you know, he says that's what needs to be done with, you know, religion. Just we need to get it out. Just drill it out of our lives so it doesn't, you know, poison us. It's like, well, that's not very tolerant. It's like saying, and then these atheists, we just need to get them out. We just need to destroy them, obliterate them so they never exist. It's like, no, you know, you can believe what you want. Just there's repercussions to that mindset.
Yeah,
you know, when you open
I know
up
what
the,
you're saying. I think, you know, in his circle of influence, it's pretty limited to, you know, people who he's talked very strongly on the environment and climate change. Some things he says make sense, but he can be pretty offensive at times. And since I'm a Christian, the only thing I really value out of him is his sharp biting humor when it's not offensive, which probably kind of sounds contradictory. but with that, we've already been talking 1 hour and 3 minutes, and I haven't heard a peep from Don. So, Don, are you still on the air? Well, anyways, I am at work, and I'd like to end the show soon, and you're still at work. Am I correct?
It is that time. It's at midnight, everyone turns into a pumpkin. Cinderella has to go home.
And I think this has been one of the best shows we've had in 2 or 3 months, because we were all focused. We all had relevant theories and things to weigh in on, and I thought it was really well done. So with that, do you want to do a conclusion? Would you like to do a conclusion?
My conclusion is that more is less, and less is more. Take everything Michael Moore says with a grain of salt, but do take it and follow the truth wherever it leads you.
It reminded me of a parable, kind of like take the communion wafers and the wine, but you know, make sure it's like for the right reason. But yes. I wanted to mention something funny I did today. So I went into there's two pools at the gym, the heated pool and the regular cool pool, like the Olympic side. So I was in there by myself, and I was singing H-O-T, we're on the fire's edge. And I was doing sign language with my fingers, H-O-T, while I was singing, because nobody was in there. And there's a big rotunda in the ceiling where it kind of echoed. And I had fun just singing by myself in the pool.
Until you found out that someone secretly videotaped it and posted on YouTube, and we have 10 million people hits, which actually would be good for the show. Maybe that's what you should do.
But when my voice was clear like 5 hours ago, it was like, H-O-T, we're on the fire's edge. But I was singing really good then. Now I don't feel like I can pull it off. But for some reason that song, I noticed I'll give you a plug. I noticed your song only once, but that's not the real title. It had 1,784 hits.
It's
the one that you mentioned that. Yeah, it grew
yes.
exponentially in one day.
Hey guys.
All
John,
go ahead.
John, do you want to make a conclusion?
Sure.
Yeah, John and I were talking about how I was singing a song in a giant heated pool by myself, because I was in the room in a community pool by myself, and I was singing a song.
Okay.
I don't know. It's kind of like running around your house naked once, like trying to get away with things in public, but when you're not sure if somebody's watching.
Okay.
I think I've maybe been alone too long. And I need a companion, because why am I doing these kinds of things?
No. I don't even know why you came up with that analogy, but I'll leave that to you. But for the most part...
Well, I do have good news, you guys. Oh, Don, you can make your conclusion, but I hit the $2,000 mark in my bank now, and I have enough money to visit on spring break. March 20th to the 24th. I'll probably fly into Reno and then I'll take... Wait! I'm going to fly into Reno and then I'm going to drive a rental car down to L.A. the last few days.
Okay.
So what changed?
Okay.
Was it Lola not being around that you're saving money? Because this is abnormal behavior.
Don't ask, John. Don't ask.
No, one reason is because I am feeding Lauren less. Another reason is that I got a roommate and he paid me $400 rent. And the other reason is I worked a lot of overtime and I got a $1,200 check this week and a $500 check the week before. So.
Well, keep up.
Well, anyway, So, Don, do you have a conclusion?
Yeah, I kind of do. It's not going to be very long. I just wanted to mention that all of this fake news, one of my writers, my last writer, she brought up the alternative facts and alternative news. Now, she's a journalist, as I am. And this has to be curtailed some way. These journalists, the media, Donald Trump may be right that the media has become dishonest, puppets of the powers that be, and we need to actually be very, very vigilant on what they're producing. It's opinionated, it lacks credibility, and it's just yellow journalism. It's just it's terrible. That's not the way that journalists should have been trained. And so we're going to have to watch our journalists and their products, because in many instances, with all the incorrect information in it, it's not news. It's just garbage. It's fictional writing, and that's not what the American public or anyone in the world needs. We need to make sure that we keep our journalists transparent and as close to facts as they possibly can get. And I just wanted to mention that, because this fake news thing bothers me, because I am a journalist and political science, and both of those things require facts and the truth, and we've lost it. We have completely lost it, and for us to get it back, we're going to have to be very vigilant and very strong to stick to our guns and make sure that those things reoccur.
I have a comment on that, because I don't think Trump realizes when he's attacking the media that the only way that he's going to be painted in a good or a bad light is the media. And intellectuals who, like, identify with the Washington Post or the Atlantic Monthly or even the upscale journalism, he's going to have to behave in order to be painted in a good light. So no matter how he wants to contour the facts, he's still going to be controlled by the media. But then, as Michael Moore said tonight in his movie, Donald Trump is a media invention. So the media and their constant coverage of him is partially why he won the office.
Well, that's because entertainment has become entertainment news, and that's driven by ratings, and ratings are driven by revenue dollars. So that's probably not going to change. And the other thing is, Donald Trump's been doing this. He's 70. You think about this. This isn't a 25-year-old man or 30-year-old man. He's 70. He's a billionaire who runs multiple corporations. So, you know, when you start thinking, oh, he's got to change or it's the end of the world, it's like he's been doing this his whole life. Well, why would he stop right? Oh, by the way, I've got the devil calling me, so I got to.
Okay, right, good night.
All right, and I've got to get back to work. So.
I have to. Me too. So I'll see you guys Sunday night, okay?
Sunday night. All right,
good
babe.
Night. Good night.
Thanks for calling.
I'm going to play one of John's songs. Good night.
Good night.
Stay up late at night. Am I?
Thank you for joining the show. We'll see you Sunday.